Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Today, we are pleased to have with us Virginia Bailey. Virginia holds a PhD and an MA in English from the University of Exeter. She founded and co-edits Riptide, which is a short story journal, and she's also the co-editor of the political series of the Africa Research Bulletin. She lives in Exeter. Her first novel, when she was still Ginny Bailey, was Africa Junction, and now Virginia Bailey has written Early One Morning, a lovely novel that we'll be talking about today. Early One Morning is about the past in present tense and the now in past tense, and how moments of decision change the course of a lifetime, and how moments of indecision can do the same thing. Whether you're dealing with an open city, Rome, during World War II, or your own day-to-day triumphs, failures, or simply bumping into the right man or woman in the street because you missed or made your bus, or stopped for coffee or not. Life is a series of those stops, detours, and trapdoors, or open fields of golden light and actinic suns and clear blue skies. This is our fate, and there's not much we can do about it, so you grab each moment and try to hold it and then let go when you need to let go. So our heroines, protagonist, whoever you will, Chiara, Maria, Daniel, who is hidden from us, and a host of other characters here, Father Antonio, poor Cecilia, almost prescient Assunta, Gennaro, they all play parts, and even though they may be only sketched for a few pages or paragraphs, and this is how you know a book is good, they remain with us for what they stood for, both in terms of character or in plot movement. All in all, this wonderfully written book does not only take place in an occupied Rome in 1944 and a free Rome of 1973, but in a world, as I said, where themes are no different than ours as we go through lives in our daily waking day-to-day reality. So with that, welcome, Virginia, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for that lovely introduction.
You're welcome.
I loved that description of Assunta as prescient.
Well, she is, and she's... I have to do this because I always start asking you questions that I'm so interested in. Before I do that, why don't you tell us a little bit about you and Maria, Rome, and your Bella Bionda phase, and then go into how that all turned into this work and how Danielle pestered you throughout it.
Well, Maria is a 16-year-old in the novel and first goes to Rome in the 1970s, and so she's the one whose experience, although she's not me, her experience in some way mirrors mine, in that I first went to Rome in the 1970s as a 16-year-old and fell in love with the city and the language and the food and my own gorgeousness there. Yes, it was my Bella Bionda phase, as you quite rightly say. I didn't know that I might have, like any blonde, blue-eyed, pink-cheeked foreign girl might have in Rome at that time. I didn't know what my own impact might be, and was very entranced with it. People, men, I mean, breaking into song on street corners as I passed. So I was very intoxicated with my own loveliness in Italian eyes, and that was part of, I think, the process of falling in love. And this is sort of intimated in some of Maria's experience there. It's not all lovely, all of that. It wasn't all lovely, that attention, but some of it was. So in writing a book set in Rome, I wanted to revisit some of that experience, which is still very vivid in my mind because it was so new and because it was so formative.
And it translates so well because, having been in Rome a couple of times, just the way you describe it is, like I said, you know, you can almost feel yourself leaning against a wall that's warm from sun and just kind of being there and experiencing the sounds, the horns, the people, like you said, singing, the traffic, the food, especially, and the food plays a really important part of this book, doesn't it?
Yes, I think that one of my senses that was awakened by being in Rome and was that culinary one. There's a smell that, because I went to stay with my aunt who lived in Rome then and very kindly, from my point of view, still does. And there was a smell in her kitchen, this tiny little kitchen that was almost like a cupboard, which again, I had no experience of people living in such small spaces. And in this little kitchen, there was this smell, which is, I know now, a kind of combination smell of olive oil and coffee and some spices or herbs and garlic. I'd never even eaten garlic before. And also the actual smell of the gas used for cooking. And the combination of all of those, if I smell something like that again, and because it's a combination smell, you don't come across it all the time, it still transports me. And every time I go to Rome, even though I've been there every year and I've lived there twice, when I, you know, for more extended periods, every time I go, I have that, at some point, I have this sort of wells up in me, this absolute delight. It's just a delight in being there. And so I think the food, because of the whole notion of food and sharing it and eating it and relishing it, it's not that we didn't have all right food in my home, but it wasn't like that. That was a new thing. And that very first evening I arrived, I mean, stop me if I bore you, because I've talked about this before, but again, it's another thing that I still can connect with. We arrived late. I was with my big brother and the plane was delayed, first time I'd flown as well, and my aunt came to meet us and drove us in the dark to her flat, so we hadn't seen Rome. And then some people that she'd invited round to greet us and make us welcome were waiting us, and it was nearly midnight, and they hadn't eaten. They'd waited for us. And that was amazing. It was mega. It was like, wow. You know, that had never happened before. That's not what happened at home. In fact, if you were late for dinner, you were in trouble. And meal times were at certain moments, and if your dinner had to be kept for you, it was covered over and put in the oven, and the oven was turned down low. But the idea that people wouldn't eat until you came.
Well, the concept of time is so much different. But the thing you did, and that's, and why I said the book is, one of the reasons why the book is so good, is that Maria, you translate what you just explained into a paragraph in the book when Maria recognizes the smell but can't place it. And it does in a sense play a pivotal part of the book, because it gives you an intimation, or it did me, of what's to come, because I knew. And I don't want to spoil anything, you know, so I'll just dance around it. But it's true. Well, let's go back into what we're talking about is the young girl who I really do see you in her in 1973, and what she's searching for. Go back to Chiara and how this whole thing started out. And you can go back to the short story that was Daniel before it became a novel.
Yes. So the first chapter is in which the kind of inciting incident for the whole narrative takes place. I wrote almost like a standalone piece. And that starts in October 1943 in occupied Rome, when my heroine, Chiara Ravello, who is looking to flee Rome with her sister, Cecilia, is called to the Jewish quarter, to the ghetto of Rome, by her friend Gennaro, who has a bar there. because there's something going on. And she and he are both involved in printing and distributing anti-fascist pamphlets, and he calls on her to help him destroy these. And then when she gets there, discovers that it's nothing to do with them, what's going on. It's that the Jews of Rome are being rounded up. So she bears witness to that event just because she's there. She just happens to be there. And then she happens to catch the eye of a woman on the back of one of these trucks. And something is communicated silently between them. And she finds herself stepping forward and claiming this woman's son as her own nephew. So rescuing this child without forethought. And the idea for that, you know, it seems miles away, doesn't it, from 1973 and a girl going to Rome. But they're the two different bits, the two different poles of what inspired me. And the novel is a bringing of them together. So at the beginning, I was writing a sort of coming-of-age story of a 16-year-old girl in Rome. But what really excited me was this idea of the child, this rescued child. And I didn't know at the beginning how I could bring them together. And in fact, I didn't really want to tell. I kept turning away from the 1943 story because it seemed a very difficult one to tell. And I'd written that chapter partly to get it out of my system because it had been there for a very long time, that idea. And when I started to think about writing about Rome, I kept thinking about, you know, the period of occupation, which has always fascinated me. And then thinking, no, don't go there, that's too hard. Let's write about the 1970s. But in the end, I couldn't ignore the 1940s and that powerful tale.
Which is why it's in the present tense.
Yes. The present tense, it has... I wouldn't normally choose it. I think my default setting, and I always say this if I teach a creative writing class as well, is third person past tense. That's the best. That's the most obvious and easiest, most accessible way of writing a story. But the present tense I used in Early One Morning, partly to differentiate between the chapters set in 1940s and the ones set in the 1970s, in hopefully a kind of way that signals it subliminally to a reader without it being clunky. But also because it has that immediacy and that feeling of you don't know what's going to happen next, and the person, it's history unfolding. It could go either way, this feeling of being at the mercy of bigger events, really.
Yeah, and the other interesting thing you said is about in the polar sense between Maria and, I can say Chiara, but I don't think that's right either. Can you say it again? Because I was saying Chiara, and that's all wrong.
Chiara. Claire it is, isn't it, I think, in English. Clara, even.
But you say, you know, they're polar. It's almost as if they're orbiting around something that, and I'm not giving anything away because the reviews have talked about this. They're orbiting around something that is almost ineffable. It's in the beginning. They're orbiting around something that is not really codified, crystallized until a certain portion, very small portion of the book, and there's this lack of knowledge on both sides.
Yes.
But yet they both know surreptitiously at some points what it is they're looking for throughout the book. And I did want to mention one thing about the beginning, and this is another really I don't want to say cool, but it is kind of cool the way you write. It's that
the only cool thing about me
is that when the soldier asks her about the boy being her nephew, And when he gives her the look that she doesn't understand.
Yes.
That look is, I know what that look is.
Ah.
And I know, you know, there is some kindness in every something. You know, there's always this kernel. And he looks that way and he knows, but she doesn't. And but he knows what he's doing.
Yes. Ah, I think that... Oh, I'm so glad that you got that.
Well,
and that you picked up on it. But, yes, I felt that, that she doesn't have a clue that he kind of knows.
Well, she's always so suspicious, like she is with the couple that help her with her sister. She... Or the little boy, and she's just so suspicious that it might be something that's that she doesn't extend gratitude. She just hurries away as fast as she can, and she does that through much of her life. And you know, why is that? Why is it that, you know, I would much rather be victimized and still trust than to immediately distrust for the rest of my life.
Can I defend her? I don't think she always does that. And when she makes that mistake with the couple that try and help, she tries to undo it. But she is at that point in a very fearful position with these two people to look after, her sister, who's a liability and very dependent and also hostile to Daniele, and this little kid who she doesn't know and who keeps wanting to run away, and she's in, you know, occupied area of the country, and he doesn't have any papers. So, you know, she's got reason to be ultra careful, and she's fearful, and bad things have happened to her.
I always think about, you know, I'm so proprietary about my passport. I don't want to ever send my passport away to Tanzania to get a visa and have them send it back to me. I just want to keep it with me. And back then, though, your papers were literally your life.
Yes.
And absent those papers, the worst thing in the world could happen to you instantaneously. That's something that's always scared me, almost like in the middle of the night kind of scared.
Yes. I had an interesting time reading about all the different little places in Rome, in occupied Rome, where papers were being forged and you know, details erased and new pictures put in. And the, I don't know if it remained in the end, but I think it did, that when they're trying to get false papers, it's the nuns at somewhere called Santi Coronati. And I read a memoir of somebody who had been in hiding in Rome and who'd got false papers from these very nuns. And I think, that was one of the...
It's so funny that you don't know whether it's still in there and I do. How is that possible?
Okay, it probably is. But
it's in there, trust me.
It's possible because of the way I wrote it, that I wrote an awful lot that I think I'd like to find a more efficient way of writing, but I haven't quite achieved it yet. So there's a big hinterland that I created that I then thought, no, I don't need any of this. I needed to know it, but it doesn't all need to go in.
Well, just so you know, the interesting thing about your portrayal of the nuns is you did not give them any reason. You didn't give them kindness or a reason for doing it. They just did it.
Yes.
And you didn't attribute anything to that. You know, they were nuns, yes. But they just had this elf-like thing they did in the middle of the night where they created a safe haven for people who otherwise wouldn't have it at all. But you didn't reward them. It was just, this is what happened. And I really liked that too. So you did keep it in.
Good.
One person that, I mean, everybody in the book is actually, other than the Nazis, obviously, everybody is kind of good. Even Father Antonio and his continuing mea culpas, he's or at least to me, you tell me whether Father Antonio, and maybe you meant it this way, is he a good person? Did he do something horrible? Where is it?
Well, he started off as, he kind of developed, I suppose, the way that characters do. He started to go his own way, and at the beginning I conceived of him as somebody who wasn't really good, whose interest, he was following his self-interest, and he wasn't really thinking about, he was making decisions about what was good for everybody without any consultation, although that continues to be true, by the end, with, as you say, his mea culpas and his attempts to remedy the damage that he'd done, I started to think, oh, okay, maybe he's not that bad after all. And then somebody, I actually know a priest who's called Father Tony here, and somebody said to me, one of my nieces said, oh, is he modelled on our Father Tony? And I was really horrified that this priest might think that I suspected him of being such a controlling figure.
Yeah, it's funny when Maria, like, really, in modern parlance, disses him at the end of the...
Yes.
I felt kind of bad for him at that point when she does that. And then I realized, look, I'm dealing with a 15-16-year-old girl,
yes,
and she's allowed to do that. And you may have done it. You may have been like that. But at yes, times she is somewhat... And at times she is ungrateful.
Yep.
So when you... I'm not attributing this to you, but you describe her breasts twice.
In really?
Yeah, you do. Well, you know, creamy, ample. But the thing is, I think it's lovely. It's not being prurient at all. It's a lovely description. But I think what it was is that the clothes you gave her, which were not her clothes, the clothes you gave her literally and figuratively cloaked her the way it seems like you must have felt when you were there. Did you get a chance to wear clothes like that? You must have.
I got a little tiny taste of that, but no, not really. I mean, in that I did have the feeling of Rome being my stage, and there was a little bit of dressing up and parading going on. But for Maria, she has a whole sort of wardrobe room with props, with little silken bolero jackets and beautiful period vintage clothes that Chiara has collected and offers her. So, no, I didn't ever have that. That was, that just sort of, again, took on its own life and became an interesting kind of dynamic between the two, between the older woman and the girl.
Well, Maria does seem really hot, and I think that she would have been she would have been groped way more than one time by that guy on the bus or whatever, especially in Rome. I mean, it seems like she would have been groped continually.
I think she probably was, and but the story isn't about how she coped with that. Although that tale that she tells,
yes,
she's telling the story really because she found something to do about it, and fought back and got the other women on the bus on side. And I did actually experience something very similar myself, and it was quite an empowering kind of moment.
It was interesting, yeah. When you say cornflower blue, that always evoke something in me. And also when she goes out with a really nice dress, but she wears her the top that Chiara thinks looks like a t-shirt that is too small for some guy, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like a combination of things. And Maria says, well, I don't care, I'm wearing it. And that's when that 15, 16-year-old thing comes out. And that might have been you too, who knows? But you know who I feel? Okay, who do I feel the most sorry for in the book?
Who?
Yeah, who would you think I feel the most sorry for?
Who gets the rawest deal?
Yep, that's exactly right. Who gets the rawest deal?
Well, you don't mean Daniele's family.
Nope.
Because they do get a raw deal, but so many others did. No, I don't know. Who do you feel most sorry for?
Barry.
Okay.
Because he's a nice guy.
He is a nice guy. he is a nice guy. It's funny that the book's being dramatized on the radio here, and they've really picked out that he's a nice guy, because he comes across as a really loving father. But I don't think you should feel sorry for him, because although he gets a raw deal in that Maria is very unforgiving and full of her own rage, the way that teenagers can be, I think she is also going to move. You know, she does know who her father is, really, and that is hinted at towards the end.
But she forgives her mother after she sees Helen, and mm-hmm. and she compliments her mother on the fact that she looks younger than Helen, and
yes.
she cries, and she understands finally what her mother has gone through, especially because of that smell and mm-hmm. and that day, and, you know, a mother yes. holding a small child, similar to another mother holding a small child. And I don't mean it in a funny way. It's just that Barry, you know, he comes in at night and he opens the door of her bedroom to check and see how she's if she's doing well. And he goes jogging and he says, "You can bring my camera."
Yes.
So many little things. You are the writer and you put those in there.
Yes.
And that evokes a response in me that here he is and he's no longer, in my mind, going to be a part of her life. It just doesn't seem like it would be that.
Well, something has shifted, that's
yes.
for sure, yeah, between her and both of them. But, and she can't go back to being who she was before she knew.
No, she can't, but one...
But I do think that she has moved towards a place where she will recognize how important he is and what his role has been.
Perhaps so. In your new books, I know it has one character from this
yeah.
book, but I don't know who it is. But I think I can guess, but I'm not going to. well, in any event, and then it's not that you paint yourself into a corner at the end, but, and again, I won't give away anything, but it's just that, like, at one part of the end, you kind of have to jump. You have to jump a little bit. To get everything right at the end. You just have to jump, you know what I mean?
Like, yes.
Yeah. So you thought about that, how you would do that. Because it's not that the book... Yeah, it's a combination. The ending is a combination. Some books end, I just read one where it's wrapped up, tied, ready to be shipped, and the reader doesn't have to do any work. But here, and then some books you go, I wonder what the heck happens now.
Mm.
And your book kind of combines the two. You know that because of that jump you did, that something's going to happen, but you really, as a reader, have to,
depending on what.
No, unless if you're a romantic, mm. you're going to think one way. And if you're not, you're going to think perhaps a different way. Because of the character flaws of one particular person.
Yes. Yeah. I've got my ideas on what happens next, but they don't go that far. A couple of people have asked me if I'm going to write a sequel. No, is probably the answer to that. And more have said that they would like to hear the whole thing again, but from Daniele's point of view.
Yeah.
And he's largely silent, as you know, in Early One Morning. And is a mystery to Chiara, at least.
He never gives her until whatever, in a very unusual and poignant way, he never gives her what she wants. But she's still, even with the father's actions, she's still, and always will, it appears, be giving him unconditional love.
Yes.
And she doesn't have to. And in the beginning, she goes, oh, geez, do I really have to do this?
Yeah.
And so that's what makes a good person. you know, someone who takes care of their father who has Alzheimer's when all the sisters and brothers won't, would rather have a life of her own outside of the house and, you know, go to parties and see people, and instead is there taking care of somebody who she loves. You know, it's this, I guess, what makes you perhaps not human, perhaps something more than human, you know, in almost in a religious sense.
Oh, it could be. Yes.
Or a Christian with a small c instead of a capital C.
Yes, I think there's something else as well, that he's her only chance at motherhood. That she sees that as well. But
he wasn't.
Maybe she doesn't get that much back. But she gets enough. Or maybe, you know, sometimes it is that. It's not like looking after your father with Alzheimer's when your siblings won't, I don't think. There's more than that. There's always the hope that he's going to grow into a person who can appreciate their life and live it.
Well,
she always hopes that, I think, and that she will be the instrument that has allowed that to happen.
Well, in America, it's always like he's just going through a phase. That's the expression.
Yes.
And when he appears on her doorstep, you know, face down, you know, and
Yes. It's,
you know, it's hard to look at that as being a phase, but that's exactly what she does do. It's a very interesting interplay between the father and the father and the son, and what if maybe perhaps she's the Holy Spirit. But it's a very interesting interplay, and it must have been really hard for you to do, since the thing started out with this absent protagonist. That was the thing, and in one of your interviews, you kind of say, "I wanted just like Kiara, you wanted to get rid of him." But you couldn't. He was there, and you're wherever you write, looking over your shoulder, saying, no, here I am. And you were stuck with him, too.
Yes, and and I suppose, like Kiara, not only was I stuck with him, but I loved him.
Really?
And I just didn't... even though there he was, this sort of sullen, silent, ungrateful child... and somebody asked me in an interview, did I make him deliberately challenging Daniele, or did it just come with the territory? And I wanted to say, all right, he was a bit, of course he's challenging, and of course he runs away all the time, and of course he's defiant, and all the rest of it. But, you know, so are lots of other people. Doesn't stop you loving them.
It was like...
And some of his attributes, some of his ways of behaving, I know of people whose children have behaved as badly with less reason, and they haven't given up on them.
He does have this powerful reason, but it's almost as if he doesn't want to accept that he was rescued, salvaged. It's like when I read The Goldfinch, it's like, you know, in the beginning, the woman is, you know, his mother is gone. But it's like for the rest of the 1,000 pages of the book, he can't get, it's like part of me is going, all right, get over it, you know? Just get over it. And there was a moment where I was thinking, why doesn't he just admit that this wonderful woman has given him all this love, and that he knows what happened, but okay, I can let it go. And okay, I don't want to think. I tend to go on and then give something away, so I won't.
Yeah, no, it's tricky, isn't it?
It's difficult.
But it just takes him a long time.
Yes, it does. And the way, and it's lovely the way that you convey his change, the sea change. And I've never seen it done that way.
Oh.
I mean, without words, without words being spoken. And in a somehow vault of failed communication that finally Oh, yeah. So when you have a middle ear problem, can you actually be manipulated by two doctors who spin you around? And
What she's got is a condition called benign positional vertigo. I don't know if it's called positional, actually. Benign something or other, vertigo, in English. And it is a middle ear or inner ear malady that manifests with this dizziness. And I know because I had it. And there is this way of treating it that involves sort of tipping you up and holding you in a certain position. I'm actually demonstrating it to you as I stand here. And waiting for this sort of... Oh, obviously, I'm very poor on medical things, but yes, there is a kind of manipulation that can be done, which was in its very early stages at that period that I'm talking about, even though it's an old-fashioned kind of thing, because it is a sort of laying on of hands. Mostly, most people seem to not intervene now, but it's quite an unpleasant thing. It makes you feel seasick.
I know, and when the doctor did that, the American doctor—wait a minute, was he American? I think he was.
He was an American. He was on his way to Japan. Conference.
And it was like one of those things I talked about in the introduction. One of those things that just she happened to be there at the time that he was there, and I felt so happy, like if I was a child. I felt so happy for her, like I felt like clapping in glee, you know? It was like, but poor, I feel so sorry for her, because then when and that was really interesting, the way you stuck the movie producer in there, and Simone goes, is it pornographic movie?
So he was in a Dario Fulminante, yes, I enjoyed inventing him. He had a bigger role in an earlier version, but it was sort of going off piste quite a long way.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yes. But it's also kind of says something about Simone and her character and her experience of life in Rome, that she kind of knows such things.
Yeah, well, Simone is a character unto herself as well, especially like, you know, at the end where she says to Assunta, can you go fix us a cup of tea? Which, you know... And Assunta is like all these muttering all these things. Oh, and you know, one of the most wonderful things is when Maria goes from church, and there's nothing better in Rome than going into a church. I mean, I could do that the whole time I was there. I could just go in from church to church.
Always, there's so many as well, and you can just pop in. And what amazes me is there's always people in there doing something or other.
You explain that very well too. And it's something that if you were doing outside would be really weird.
Oh, yeah, the nuns and the woman contorting herself. And, yeah, the strange comforts to be had from people's peculiar behavior inside churches.
But the way she collects the cards, they're not mass cards. They're the cards of the saints. But I didn't know and the way she quizzes Assunta, and the way the two saints, and she goes, which one is it? Oh, little one, the one that was. And then they're horrible. They're martyred in all these horrible ways.
Yeah.
But I like the way she quizzes her, and it's like this interesting relationship they have.
It was a way of kind of establishing that they had formed a connection and had their own little their own dialogue going on, Assunta and Maria, without spending too long explaining it.
Yeah.
But Assunta was one of those characters. Sometimes I have to work to sort of build a character up, and then sometimes they appear fully formed. And Assunta was one who appeared fully formed, with her holy pictures in her pocket and her book that she painstakingly, her Lives of the Saints that she reads from and takes wisdom from, and her strange ideas of what she can see that others may not be able to.
Yeah, and she gives Chiara some advice at the very end that pretty much is the right advice to give.
Yes.
It's exactly the right advice to give, and it's good that she was there to give it. And I'm not obsessive compulsive about furniture and the way your apartment looks, but whoa, what a mess it must have been. It was horrible. And the back room is like, I knew the piano, I knew what the piano forte, I knew when they opened the door, it would come flying out of there.
It's gonna come shooting.
And then I felt sorry for, Assunta brings her nephew or whoever it is, Marco, and
yes.
there appears Maria in a negligee, which that's when the creamy breasts are spilling out of it. And I felt so sorry for him. I mean, it's like, this is what he sees when he gets there. And
yes.
The poor guy, and he's handsome. They're all handsome.
They're all handsome, without exception.
But, yeah.
Yes, I enjoyed doing that scene.
Yeah. I can imagine.
And then the moment when Chiara walks in, and there's all this sort of stuff going on in her apartment that she didn't even know about. And, yeah.
And the leather jacket.
Mm.
Also the scene where Daniela, flips the ring. The ring is important. It's not as important as in The Lord of the Rings. But
no.
But when he just flips it to Maria's mom.
Yes.
The leather jacket and the ring are both very important, aren't they?
They are. And that moment with the ring says, well, the ring's important because it gets passed from one person to another without the person to whom it's been passed knowing its significance, really. And then it comes back, it sort of travels with them and then comes back to where it started off from.
And what's interesting, it appears in the photograph, and
then
behind the photograph, that's probably more labyrinthine than you actually wrote, than you thought.
yes, that's true.
But it's connected in so many different ways.
Yeah, I see that scene there where Daniele throws the ring and Maria's mama Edna catches it and it could have fallen down the well, as being one of those ones that could slip by. It's just a memory that Edna has, but it actually feels like it's right in the middle for me. And it's the only scene in the 1950s. And him throwing the ring says, to me, seemed to say so much about him, that she could have missed it and it would have fallen down the well. And it is actually a very precious thing, and it's also an heirloom, and it's a thing that he came by legitimately, which isn't true of all of the things that pass through Daniele's hands.
And why this one? Like, normally he would have pawned it or whatever, and he chose instead, and he did it rather jauntily too.
Yeah.
But as a reader, she's not going to miss it. She's going to catch it.
Yeah.
That's the whole novel right there. In one. It is, isn't it? I mean,
yeah.
I can just see him flipping it with the flick of his thumb and it spinning in an arc above the well. And yeah.
Yeah.
And that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Because it's the arc. It's the arc of the novel.
Yes. Yes, and that whole scene came from Chet Baker,
Yeah.
From finding out that, from this whole idea of Daniele having a trumpet and liking music and then the jazz music thing,
mm-hmm.
and then looking into what music was around and discovering that Chet Baker was quite big in Italy and played in Italy in 1956, and then finding a YouTube clip of him playing in Rome in 1956 and thinking, ooh, what if Daniele was there at that concert? And then who else might have been there? Looking around and finding this blonde-haired English au pair. I'm just... Yeah, I mean, that's the sort of magic of making stuff up, really, that one thing can... One little discovery can spark all of these other ideas.
I know.
So that then it becomes as if it was real, if I watch that clip now of Chet Baker, I think, Daniele's just down there in the audience.
And it's funny because you carry, from the very beginning when he has that lizard look, when he looks, and you know he's beautiful from the beginning and he's beautiful at the end, and at that dance, you know that all the girls are looking at him, and he knows it too. And it's interesting, I didn't even think about that being in the middle, between times, and the fact that at that point, even though he has all of his, what does he have? Does he have vanity at that point? Is he egocentric at that point? Does he just, it's interesting. Because he grabs her and just,
I think he's very confident. He doesn't doubt that she's going to dance with him, this girl, and that she'll come out with him. He doesn't doubt any of that. But also, although you don't see it from his point of view, just from Edna's, but then also there's reference to it later, and Chiara remembering that summer and thinking that was when he was sweet again, and it did feel like, suddenly the English girl disappears, but maybe that would have been a way of him finding himself and getting more stable sooner if she hadn't gone rushing back home.
That's, until this interview, I didn't really think of how many intricate little boxes and places that you had hidden in the book. But now I'm thinking of the scene where she takes, after the war, when they're trying to gather as much information about the families and the missing people, where Chiara does an act that isn't really a good act, but she does it because she doesn't want to lose something that she values more than anything in the world.
Yes.
That's why you changed the name, though. You didn't want to make it that bad. Right?
Yeah.
Because it was pretty bad.
Yes. But a bit like, I think it was bad that she hid something. She lied. But also, her reasons weren't only, I don't think they were only selfish and that she didn't want to lose him. They were also that, at least with her, she knew he was loved and cared for and safe, or as safe as another human being could make him. And any change in his any move, you couldn't know that. You couldn't know that he would be. So it wasn't just her own desire to hang on to him.
But he was the most important. Yes. And some of the reviews have even said, what happened to her in between? What are some of the details of her life in between, other than being a translator? It's almost like this is her life. And it's funny, talking to you, you seem very protective of her.
Very what? Sorry?
Protective of her. Every time I've leaned towards her being less than something, you go, well, yeah, but she was doing this because of this and this. It seems like you don't want her to be anything but perfect in a certain way.
No, I know she's not perfect. I'm just... I'm probably protective of her. Somebody suggested at a book group that I was talking to recently that perhaps his mother hadn't been pushing him forward and hadn't been giving her a look to indicate, please save my child, and that she just snatched him. And then I did feel protective of her, because I thought, I don't really think there's anything in what I've written that would indicate that that it was just her being opportunistic and stealing a child. But I'm going to ponder that, my defensiveness about Chiara.
Well, it's funny too, because the family from which he's he's so formative when he leaves his family, his real family that you might disagree with, that scene is so well done because the mother is dressed so well, and she has those earrings, and he has his suitcase, and in his suitcase are all the things that he needs,
yeah,
and toys, and clothing, and she, as one of the reviews said, she looks as if she's preparing for an escape that couldn't take place, and the father too. It's a portrait. It's almost like some type of Renaissance portrait at the back of the van, the three of them there, and then the look, and in the portrait you can see the look, you know, the look of, you know, a total sacrifice at the same time as, you know, total love. I mean, I don't know. I mean, you can see her eyes. I can see her eyes. I don't know what that, I can't really describe what that look is. When you lock eyes like that, it always means something.
It's such a momentous thing to do, to have done, isn't it?
I don't.
To push your own child away, to make that decision, to have that within you that you could, rather than clutching the child to you, that you think this is their only chance.
Well, it's, I think one of the reviews actually said it. They said it was a true Sophie's choice.
Mm.
And I wouldn't really necessarily put it that way. It was, because it wasn't that type of choice. It was a rational, it seems to me that behind the emotion that the mother, who I saw for a moment, who I really admired, it seems as if she made a very rational decision, that she looked at the pros and cons of the situation, analyzed them, and in a split second decided, after verifying that the person she had locked eyes with would do the thing that she wanted more than anything. It was very, I don't know.
I think you're right. I think that's how I perceive it as well. And so the person who I'm most in awe of is Daniele's mother. The idea that somebody, and I believe there were such people, could do that. Yeah, it's rational and it's instinctive and it's done at gunpoint, really.
It is.
And it's extraordinary. And I did read an account of that day when the Jews were rounded up in Rome, and there was a story of somebody claiming one of the children and having that child handed down. But the child, that was a girl, and she cried for her mother so loudly that she was handed back. It was obvious. So it's the fact that it isn't obvious. There's lots of different little factors playing there, but one of them is how resolute his mother was, and another is that it was Chiara who in that moment is quite determined, even if she regrets it or wishes it undone sometimes afterwards. And then the other thing is Daniele, who, though he shouts at the beginning, then doesn't. So whether that's because he's obedient to whatever his mother told him to do, or whether it's because Chiara's,
she says what's going to, she says what's going to happen if he doesn't, and
yeah.
See, and I don't mean to be complimenting you, because we're both talking about the same thing, but what's amazing about it, and you are trusting the reader to recognize this, is that there she is for one page, and there the soldier is for one moment. And both of those things are, again, what comes after. But you have to rely on the reader, otherwise there would be a lack of understanding as you went through the book.
Yes.
Which really interesting, isn't it? I mean, you know, because you're doing it, I'm not doing it, but I'm just telling you what you did, and you're agreeing with me.
Yes. Well, I mean, I think, yeah, but there is an expectation that the reader is going to, is going to step into that world that's the invitation, isn't it? I've right from the word go, saying, here it is. Here you are, you're on this street, you're watching this happen. And you know, don't you, reader, what the background to this is, what the bigger picture was. They don't know where they're going, but you do.
Well, it also means that, you know, you, and you should, and I don't think you ever will, is you don't, you have a certain respect for the reader, and that's really important.
Well, I do, and I think I like to read a book where there's respect for me as a reader, and so that's what I want to write as well. And I want there to be enough space. I'm not quite sure what I mean by space, but that'll do for, as a description for now, for the reader to have some, to have their own interpretation, to have some room for manoeuvre, for there to be things that are worth discussing or questioning, like, you know, was Father Antonio in the end, is he a good man or not, and about the morality of the decisions that Chiara takes, and or even to ponder on where Daniele might have gone when he goes away and what he's up to, and to fill in the gaps. I don't want to have it all filled in. I don't want it all handed over. I think it makes it less of an interesting and engaging reading and writing exercise if I claim to be to know all the answers.
Thank you so much, Virginia, for allowing us the right to interpret what you've written. And the book was great. I know it'll be chosen. I know you've been talking to book clubs, and I know it'll be chosen in my bookstore, Wellington Square Bookshop. I know it'll probably, if not certainly, be chosen as a book for our book club or one of the many book clubs that meet there. And right now it's sitting on the front table of our bookshop as well. So thank you so much for not only joining us today, but for writing such a wonderful book.
And thank you very much for inviting me, Sam.
That was Virginia Bailey talking about her book, Early One Morning. And I found it fascinating that, well, patting myself on the back, that there's so many points in the book where she and I coincided on our understanding of what was happening. But it wasn't so much me, I don't think. I think if you, as an intelligent reader, as I know my intelligent listeners are, that when you read the book, these little things that pop out, and like I said at the beginning, you know, it's like the movie Sliding Doors, you know, these things that happen in your life, and they happen every day, you know, whether you're late for a meeting or whether you forgot your keys and you ran back, make the difference between you either, you know, getting hit by a car or you seeing somebody in the market that you wouldn't have seen otherwise, and she or he changes your entire life or gives you children or gives you something that you never had. These things happen to us every day, and we let them happen without knowing, without recognizing, without, you know, doing our own little fact check. Hey, this is why I'm here today. This is the moment when someone passed me by and I either said hello or either I reached out or I did something I wouldn't normally do, like grab her and kiss her or grab her and start dancing with her. And whatever it is that happened is what makes your life what it is. And a lot of that goes on in this book, but a lot of it goes on in life, and in my life for sure. So in any event, so that was Virginia, and I'm trying to look through my notes at what we're doing next. I can't find it, but I think, here it is. Rebecca hides this on me. So we have a whole bunch of good things coming up. One is Caitlin Dowdy, who you can see on YouTube all the time. She has this YouTube channel called Ask a Mortician. She wrote this book called Smoke Gets in Your Eyes and Other Lessons from the Crematory, which is somewhat yucky, but really, really good. And one of the best books rated by me and by Donna, our manager, Donna McFadden, at Wellington Square Bookshop. And so what we're going to do is, like we did last year, we're going to do the Avid Reader's Best Books of 2015. And when Don and I get together, there's always an interesting time and interesting arguments and insults and good humor. And so that'll be coming up. We'll probably run it twice since it is the Christmas season and a good time to know what the best books of 2015 are so that you can come to our bookstore and buy them for your grandson, granddaughter, father, mother, sister, brother, or do all your shopping in our place because we have tons of stuff that you can buy there, from Lamy pens, we're the only people around that stock Lamy pens, to all kinds of interesting and exotic children's gifts. And anyway, enough of that. Come and see us. So thank you, as always, for listening today. I would love to go to Rome with Virginia Bailey. And with that, I look forward to seeing you next week here on The Avid Reader.